The Bible and Modern Science with your host, Dr. Joseph Henson of the Science Faculty of Bob Jones University. Here is Dr. Henson.
Thank you. What I would like for us to do now is to try and draw our thoughts together about some of the conclusions and consequences and necessities of an understanding, a comprehension that involves creation itself. I came back to the university to teach in 1957 and began the next summer, 1958, my graduate work down at Clemson. And for the next 8 years, I taught full-time, took either two or three graduate courses at Clemson every semester and a full load in the summertime. If I had known what I was letting myself in for when I began, I probably would never have started. And it was a very difficult time for me in many respects. I was going through some rather demanding graduate work, and much of that dealt with ideas that were obviously contrary to my biblical faith. Now, how do you reconcile that? I did not have any person that I really could go to for help in that. Maybe there was some advantage to that. It meant I had to do a good deal of thinking and wrestling and praying on my own. I did have some help from theological experts, some of whom were on the faculty here and some others as well. But not anything that helped in attempting to reconcile that. And my understanding obviously was that I was going to spend my life teaching science. How do I maintain an intellectual honesty in teaching science in view of all of the ideas that my graduate training were presenting me? Finally, there came a time when Dr. Morris and Dr. Whitcomb came out with Genesis Flood, which was of immense help to me at the time. And after I had finished, shortly thereafter, I ran across a pamphlet that was written by R.J. Rushdooney, a man whom I have admired, or at least I have admired the writing he has done. I think I have read much of what he has written, and I have never read anything he has written without great profit. I have never met the man, but I owe him a great debt of gratitude for the information that was available to me through his writings. Ran across a pamphlet that was entitled The Necessity for Creationism. We began a course at the university entitled Philosophy of Science at that time. And in that course, as well as my biology seminar courses and others, I required that pamphlet as part of the required reading for the students. It ties together some ideas in a way I really have not ever found anyplace else. And what I would like to do for the next two or three programs at least is simply go through that pamphlet, reading portions of it and discussing the ideas that are there. This was 40 years ago now, and it was pertinent at that time. But it's interesting to me that the predictions that were made in this pamphlet at that time, you can almost look out the window and see them happening before our eyes today. He was right on target with the arguments that were there. So what I want to do is begin reading that. As far as I am aware, the pamphlet is out of print. I have at least one copy of the original pamphlet tracked. It really is not that long. It was a triply folded paper, and I think it was about six, maybe seven columns long, so it's not a lengthy one, but it was tremendously helpful. There's also a film strip and a tape that came with it that I have played to most all of my upper class students since that time. So we're going to look at this. I will read portions of it, comment about it, and the purpose of this is to deal with the question of why the fuss between creation and science. Are they totally separate? Can the creationist go his way and the scientist go his way without any difficulties? I hope by the time we're through, you will understand that that really is not the case. So I'm reading beginning the first part of that pamphlet, The Necessity for Creationism, by R.J. Rush Dooney. When the first edition of Charles Darwin on the Origin of Species was published on November 24, 1859, all 1,250 copies sold out on the first day of publication. I would observe in passing that that title was a misnomer from the standpoint that Darwin's book really didn't tell us about the origin of anything. It discussed at great length what can happen to an organism once it gets here, but it doesn't tell us anything at all about how they get here. Now, the evolutionists make a great deal of this fact. It is true that all 1,250 copies of the first edition were sold out the first day. Say, oh boy, this is evidence that the whole world was waiting for Darwin. No, the whole world wasn't waiting for Darwin. There were a number of people who were very eager for that. And you, again, depending on your study and reading, are aware that Darwin was asked to write the foreword to the communist handbook. And there are tie-ins. There were a number of views that came into existence in the around the middle of the 1850s. Communism, evolution, etc. And again, that's not the purpose of our discussion at this point. So there were some people who were very eager to have it. The fact was that the scientific community in his day was not enthusiastic about it at all. And for the most part, it was rejected by the scientists of that time. This idea is overlooked. And those people, it's interesting, by the way, that the preachers in Darwin's day, for the most part, were much more enthusiastic about it than the scientists were. Westcott and Hort, for example, were highly enthusiastic about evolution and accepted Darwin's teaching about that with open arms. So many of the people on theology were open to it, much more open than men in the area of science was. I continue. The world was waiting for a theory with scientific prestige to render the Bible and God obsolete. That was the thing that was attractive about that theory to most people. It wasn't whether it was true or not, but it was simply an idea with a patina of scientific respectability which gave them some reason to reject the scripture and reject God and reject their position as creatures under a creator. The Bible was waiting for a theory with scientific prestige to render the Bible and God obsolete, and men immediately jumped on the bandwagon of Darwinism. George Bernard Shaw described the relief of men at being rid of God and declared, quote, the world jumped at Darwin, end quote. Well, part of the world jumped at Darwin. That part of the world who was eager to reject God as creator and to rebel against any kind of authority were very happy with Darwin's book. A great many churchmen climbed on that bandwagon then, and many more have done it since. The appeal is very great. Why not compromise? Why not be, quote, scientific, end quote, or scientifically respectable? When the Genesis account of creation is such a liability, why not concentrate on other matters of the faith and accommodate the Bible to evolution? Let me stop here for a comment. There are many people today who attempt to do that, including some born-again people who are trying to harmonize the Bible and evolution. Now, what these attempts end up being, if whatever is given up, it is not evolution or science. What is changed is the scripture itself. And the so-called harmonization of the scripture and evolution turns out simply to be an annihilation of the authority of the scripture. This is the thing that makes it appealing to most of those who are happy with it. When the Genesis account of creation is such a liability, why not concentrate on other matters of the faith and accommodate the Bible to evolution? Why risk being considered ignorant and backward? I don't know how that comment strikes you. You say, well, that really doesn't make any difference. I think it does. There are many people in the world today who really back away from the authoritative view of Scripture because there is a very decided stigma attached to that. And often it is an intellectual stigma that a great many people simply are not willing to put up with. They just are not, they were not going to stand still and have somebody accuse them of not being intellectual or intelligent or whatever. And they absolutely rebel at the idea of anybody looking at them and thinking that they are unintelligent or backward or not knowledgeable or whatever other term you want to apply to that. That is a stigma which they are simply unwilling to accept. Now, if you will back away from that question and think about it a little bit, what this is simply an evidence of an overweening pride, a pride that sometimes borders on arrogance. You can defend it, fuss about it, do whatever you wish to, but it is not an attitude which ought to be consistent with any Bible believer. And for an unregenerate person, this is a very potent argument. Boy, I'm not going to be looked on as being dumb or backward or ignorant because of something in the Scripture. I have a message I sometimes give that deals with this very notion that there is inherent in an acceptance of the Scripture persecution and a bunch of other things that follow automatically from it. Bernard Ram, in The Christian View of Science and Scripture, searched for more credible, reasonable interpretations which should cause no embarrassment to any man with a scientific mentality, but also with Christian convictions. Ram's purpose is to harmonize the Bible and modern science. Is such an approach tenable? Why defend old-fashioned, strict creationism? Now, that's a good question, and it is a question to which many of the neo-evangelicals, for example, have taken an improper answer, an unbiblical answer, and they are very much affected by this unwillingness to be looked on as ignorant or backward because of their acceptance of the Scripture.
Thank you, Dr. Henson. You may send email to Dr. Henson at jhenson@bju.edu. That's jhenson @bju.edu. Or write to Dr. Joseph L. Henson, Box 34621, Bob Jones University, Greenville, South Carolina, zip code 29614, in the United States of America. You're invited to listen next time for The Bible and Modern Science.